Net earnings, the bottom line measure mandated by accounting rules for corporate financial statements, factors in interest costs, taxes, and non-cash accounting charges, such as the depreciation of assets. Cash flow is the dealmaker's raw show-me-the-money measure, the amount that remains after operating expenses are paid. The financial structure of an LBO is built upon it. One way that buyout firms make profits is to use the cash flow to pay down the buyout debt. In the industry's early days, deals were formulated with the aim of retiring every dollar of debt within 5 to 7 years. That way, when the business was finally sold, the buyout firm reaped all the proceeds because there was no debt to pay off. A second way to generate a gain is to boost cash flow itself through revenue increases, cost cuts, or a combination in order to increase the company's value when it's sold. Using cash flows, there is also a third way to book a gain, without an outright sale. If a company has paid down its debt substantially, it can turn around and reborrow against its cash flow in order to pay its owners a dividend. That is known as a dividend recapitalization. In Transtar's case, Blackstone used all three means to manufacture a stupendous profit. In 1989, in line with Mossman's expectations, Transtar's cash flow reached nearly $160 million, enabling it to repay $80 million of debt by year's end. By March 1991, Transtar had paid $200 million of its original buyout debt. With substantially less debt than it had when the business was spun off, and with Transtar's cash intake growing, the company was able to borrow again to cover a $125 million dividend to Blackstone and USX. A little more than 2 years after the deal closed, Blackstone had made back nearly four times the $13.4 million it had invested. By 2003, when Blackstone sold the last of its stake in a successor to Transtar to Canadian National Railroad, the firm and its investors had made 25 times their money and earned a superlative 130% average annual return over 15 years. If this seems a bit like conjuring profits from nothing, that's largely what happened. Transtar, like Gibson Greeting, was a prime example of buying at the right time, leveraging to the hilt, and milking every drop of cash flow for profit. Soon enough, rising prices and a floundering economy would change the rules of the game, forcing buyout firms to focus more intently on improving fundamental corporate performance to generate profits, and less on financial sleights of hand. That's not to say the Transtar buyout served no purpose. It delivered a hefty profit to the pension funds and other institutions that put their money with Blackstone. The deal also assisted USX, allowing it to keep control of Transtar even as it restructured itself and sold off the subsidiary and other operations to increase the value of its stock. As to Transtar itself, the buyout didn't particularly strengthen the company, but it certainly didn't weaken it. Transtar's success showed the rest of Wall Street that Peterson and Schwartzman could excel at the buyout game. The deal also was a landmark for a second reason. It forged an abiding tie between Blackstone and Chemical Bank's Jimmy Lee that would be of enormous consequence to both. A gregarious spark plug of a man who resembled a back-gelled Martin Sheen and was known for his spiffy silver dollar suspenders, Lee soon emerged as a kingpin of leveraged finance, a banker's banker to other LBO luminaries such as Henry Kravis and Ted Forstman. Just as Drexel Burnham's Michael Milken had created the junk bond market, tapping the public capital markets to finance the corporate raiders and buyout shops of the 1980s, Lee reinvented the bank lending market with his syndicates, which allowed risk to be shared and thereby allowed much larger loan packages to be assembled. At Chemical, and its later incarnations, Chase Manhattan Bank, the name Chemical adopted in 1996 after buying Chase, and later J.P. Morgan Chase, after Chase bought J.P. Morgan in 2000, Lee would go on to play as critical a role in the stupendous growth of LBO activity in the 1990s and 2000s as Milken had with junk bonds in the 1980s. Even though Lee would do brisk business with all the major LBO shops, he would work most closely with Blackstone. Beginning with Transtar, and for the next 15 years, Lee functioned as a kind of house banker to Blackstone, financing a great many of its deals, and never siding with a competing LBO firm in a deal on which Blackstone was bidding. Theirs was a truly synergetic relationship, which helped propel both Chemical J.P. Morgan Chase and Blackstone to the top of their fields. You could argue that Blackstone made J.P. Morgan Chase as much as J.P. Morgan Chase made Blackstone, says one of Lee's counterparts at another bank. Neither would be where they are today without the other. Transtar also advertised Blackstone's readiness to ally itself with corporate chieftains in the war against raiders, and just how far it would bend to accommodate corporate America's financial and strategic imperatives. It helped establish Blackstone's reputation as an operating problem solver, in Peterson's words. In every way, it was a perfect first deal for us, says Lipson. It was highly successful quickly, and it showed we weren't looking to antagonize corporations but to be friends. Corporate partnerships became our calling card. Whereas competing buyout shops typically exercise dictatorial control over their acquisitions, Blackstone was adaptable. Its openness to splitting power or even taking a back seat to a corporate collaborator bolstered its deal flow, as Schwartzman and Peterson had hoped. Of the dozen investments that Blackstone went on to make with its 1987 buyout fund, seven would be partnerships akin to Transtar. In addition to differentiating Blackstone from the competition, Schwartzman also believed the partnerships heightened Blackstone's odds of success. Having a co-owner intimately familiar with the business, typically one that was a major customer or supplier and therefore had an interest in its thriving, would give Blackstone an advantage over competing buyout firms, staffed as they were with financial whizzes who had never run a business or met a payroll. With the prices for whole businesses escalating in step with the stock market in the late 1980s, Schwartzman felt Blackstone needed an edge to safely do deals in a higher-priced environment. That's really why we came up with the corporate partnership strategy. I just couldn't figure out how to make money buying companies unless we brought unusual efficiencies to a company by way of cost improvements or revenue synergies. The partnership approach also fit with Schwartzman's innate cautiousness. In some partnerships, Schwartzman went so far as to barter away some of Blackstone's potential upside for downside insurance in the form of a right to sell out to its partner several years later at a preset price or valuation. Some of the firm's rivals viewed such trade-offs with bemusement. To their way of thinking, ceding power and profit to hedge the downside was downright lily-livered. "We always thought Blackstone's corporate model was bullshit," sniffs one. "It was like they couldn't stand on their own. They needed help and made a lot of concessions to get it." Schwartzman's preoccupation with the possible downside was more than a reasoned response to the market dynamics of the day. It was a gut-level reflex, a kind of bête noir or obsession, former colleagues say. The rudimentary rule of investing, that one must risk money to make money, is something Steve always had a hard time coping with, says one former partner. For a world-class investor, his risk aversion was really extraordinary. Schwartzman acknowledges as much. We are more risk-averse than other private equity firms, and part of it is visceral. I don't like failure, and losing money is failing. It's a personal thing that has turned into a strategy here. Over the next two decades, the corporate partnership deals had a mixed record. But the strategy was pivotal to Blackstone's success early on, producing most of its early home runs, including investments in the Six Flags amusement parks and a second railroad, the Chicago and Northwestern Railroad. Schwartzman's caution sometimes worked against Blackstone by denying it promising deals, but it also spared it from perpetuating some of the colossal blunders that in the 1990s would damage and doom a few bullish or bull-headed rivals. Call it what you will, knee-jerk trepidation or prudence, Schwartzman's instincts would be central to Blackstone's success. Chapter 6. Running Off the Rails. The Transtar triumph produced a warm afterglow, but it didn't last long. Two misguided investments quickly ran off the tracks in 1989 and forced the young firm to rethink the way it vetted its investment options. The failures also established a harsh new unwritten rule: slip up badly enough just once, and you're out. Everyone was on notice. Not even partners were exempt. The first misfire was Wicks Companies, an unwieldy amalgam of three dozen disparate businesses that Blackstone took private for $2.6 billion in December 1988, in partnership with Wasserstein Perella, Blackstone's rival as an M&A boutique and buyout shop. Conglomerates like Wicks, once stock market darlings, had fallen out of favor and were being ripped apart. David Stockman, Blackstone's point man and strategist on Wicks, thought that Wicks would be worth more dismembered than intact. Stockman was a relentless advocate for his own deals, bombarding his colleagues with minutiae, the actuarial details of pension plans, consumer vehicle preferences, or whatever other imaginative product of his research would be the key to making an investment successful. He became legendary inside and outside the firm for calculating and writing out voluminous spreadsheets by hand, often faxing the sheets of numbers to underlings at Blackstone, who would type them into computer spreadsheets, as most other dealmakers did from the outset. A banker who worked on one of Stockman's deals remembers being dumbfounded as page after endless page of figures spat out of the fax machine during negotiations. Stockman had cracked the Wicks nut, or so he thought. He plotted to break up the company, whittling it down to a single business, Collins and Aikman, a maker of textiles, carpeting, and wallpaper. Blackstone and Wasserstein Perella each sank $122 million into the buyout, which closed the same month as Transtar, the largest investment by Blackstone for the next 7 years. Things went awry almost from the start in early 1989, when the U.S. economy started to soften. An early sign of trouble came that spring, when Wicks put Builders Emporium, then the largest home improvement retail chain in California, up for sale. Blackstone expected it to fetch as much as $250 million, one former employee says. But we ended up having to sell it over time for like $50 million. Slowing auto sales also dug into the auto fabric side of the business. The buyers also soon discovered that Wicks's former CEO, Sandy Sigaloff, a corporate turnaround artist and notorious cost slasher nicknamed Ming the Merciless, had hacked away rather too exuberantly at Wicks's managerial ranks. What we found was that Sigaloff was used to getting rid of whole layers of management for companies that were in trouble. But this company wasn't in trouble, says Schwartzman. He fired a lot of people anyhow, so there was nobody around to do the work. Nearly from the start, then, the company was a problem. Far uglier and more damaging than Collins and Aikman, though, was Blackstone's third investment, an ill-conceived $330 million LBO of Edgecombe Metals Company, the Tulsa steel distributor. In the space of just a few months, Edgecombe threatened to demolish Blackstone's investors' faith in the firm. The Edgecombe acquisition was the brainchild of Stephen Winograd, a 31-year-old M&A prodigy Blackstone lured away from Drexel. At Drexel, Winograd had played a role in a $150 million management-led LBO of Edgecombe in 1986, and later that year helped take the steel fabricator public, making a rich man of Edgecombe CEO Michael Scharf, and huge profits for Texas's Bass family and other backers of the buyout. From the moment Winograd settled in at 345 Park Avenue, he pressed the idea of a second buyout of Edgecombe, whose stock had languished after it went public. Schwartzman quickly said yes. In May, Blackstone negotiated a $330 million deal to take Edgecombe private for $8 a share, $2 above the IPO price of 1986. Like Transtar, the Edgecombe buyout was leveraged to the rafters, with Blackstone contributing just $23 million for a 65% equity stake. The buyout closed in June. David Stockman opposed the deal. Since his arrival at Blackstone a year earlier, Stockman had carved out a role for himself as a devil's advocate and doomsayer, and he argued fervently against the Edgecombe buyout. Stockman's input didn't win him many fans at headquarters. He had a habit of criticizing other people's deals, particularly in the early years, says one former Blackstone partner. Right or wrong, David was never in doubt, says David Batten, another ex-partner. Stockman's Cassandra act soon wore thin, not only because it put him at loggerheads with his partners, but because he often was just wrong. But not this time. Edgecombe made its money buying raw steel, milling it and shaping it, and selling it at a markup to auto factories, aircraft makers, and other users. Its profit margins, Stockman pointed out, were directly linked to steel prices. And if business turned down sharply, Edgecombe would find itself selling its steel inventory at a loss, and its cash flow would vanish. I had them both in my office, Schwartzman says of Stockman and Winograd. Winograd argued that the company's profits were of a repeat nature and that it had very interesting expansion prospects. Stockman said it was a dangerous deal to do and it wasn't worth the price. I could see both sides, and I voted with Winograd. It turned out to be a catastrophically wrong decision. Indeed, almost as soon as Blackstone completed the deal in June 1989, the same economic softening that had undermined the firm's breakup plans for Wix doomed Edgecombe, just as Stockman had predicted. The company was saddled with inventory that was worth less than it paid. The business situation turned very bad so quickly that Edgecombe had trouble making its first interest payment that summer, a humiliating state of affairs for Blackstone. Right out of the gate, the buyout was racing toward insolvency. Schwartzman soon threw his energies into trying to rescue the deal. He cajoled Blackstone's fund investors to stump up another $16 million of equity to try to keep the business afloat and worked tirelessly to ensure that the creditors didn't lose a dime. If Edgecombe defaulted on its debt, it might irreparably taint the new buyout firm's reputation in the credit markets. He was beside himself at that possibility and made his anxiety clear around the office. In July 1990, Schwartzman arranged to sell the nearly bankrupt company to a subsidiary of France's Usinor Sasalor S.A., then the world's largest steel company, at a steep discount to the original price. Edgecombe's senior lenders were repaid, but there wasn't enough money left to repay Blackstone. Its fund investors wound up losing $32.5 million of the $38.9 million they'd put into the deal. That Schwartzman ultimately salvaged even one-sixth of the limited partner's money was little short of miraculous in the circumstances, an ex-partner recalls. "That's where I saw Steve's brilliance," this person says. "That's where I saw how good he was. He saw the problem, and he worked doggedly to resuscitate the company." Many Blackstone fund investors viewed the entire affair less charitably. In a phone conversation, Shirley Jordan, the chief investment officer of Presidential Life Insurance, called Schwartzman a complete idiot and fumed, "I never should have given you a dime." Schwartzman says he responded, "I may not be a complete idiot, but I certainly was on this transaction." Other limited partners rendered similar judgments in less barbed language. Schwartzman may have taken responsibility in talking to outsiders, but internally he blamed Winograd and turned on him. He castigated him savagely for his deficient judgment and other supposed failings, and fired him with the bazooka blast of invective. The brutal dismissal fueled anxiety among the rank and file and contributed to the firm's reputation for being a difficult and even volatile place to work. Anything from misspelling a word in a legal document or failing to rustle up enough business could evoke Schwartzman's ire. But Winograd's experience sent the chilling message that losing money could be a capital offense. In the early years, there was an atmosphere where every deal on the principal or LBO side was do or die, says former partner Howard Lipson, who logged 18 years at Blackstone. Like life or death. At the same time Schwartzman was wrestling with problems at Collins and Aikman and at Edgecombe, the firm faced a third major setback in 1989, an ill-timed detour into stock trading that took a generous bite out of the partnership's own capital. The new business was launched on a victorious note in December 1988, when Blackstone procured another $100 million from Nikko, the Japanese bank that had made a crucial early commitment to Blackstone's first fund. This time the money would go not to the buyout fund, but to Blackstone itself. As with Wasserstein Perella's headline-grabbing pact with Nomura 6 months earlier, Nikko was putting up $100 million for a 20% cut. But Schwartzman extracted sweeter terms from his Japanese backer than Bruce Wasserstein, his friendly rival and tennis partner, had. "After Bruce did that deal," Schwartzman says, "I went back to Nikko and said I wanted another $100 million like he got, but I wanted it in the form of a joint venture with our advisory business." He knew how avidly Nikko and other Japanese brokers wanted a piece of the M&A banking business, and he and Nikko both knew that allying with a well-connected American firm was the quickest way to obtain it. Nikko resisted at first, but eventually acceded to his terms. Instead of taking a straight 20% ownership interest in the Blackstone partnership and all its operations, as Nomura had Wasserstein Perella, the Japanese accepted a 20% share of the net earnings of Blackstone's M&A advisory business over the next 7 years. In addition, Nikko would receive 20% of any returns Blackstone earned investing the $100 million. In 1995, if either party chose not to extend the investment, Blackstone would repay the $100 million along with any returns Nikko was still due. For Nikko, the deal had loads of promise. Mergers had rebounded smartly from the brief lull after the 1987 stock market fall, and in 1988 M&A was Blackstone's main fee engine, yielding close to $29 million in income. Japanese corporations and banks were snapping up American businesses and real estate, and through Peterson's ties to Japanese industrial titans, Blackstone snagged lucrative assignments advising on two of the biggest such deals that year, Sony's purchase of CBS Records and Bridgestone Corporation's purchase of Firestone Tire and Rubber Company. Nico had visions of trading on Peterson's ties to Japanese managers to capture a bigger share of the cross-border merger market. Conceivably, Blackstone could have used Nico's money to fund expansion and hire top-tier talent, or tucked it away as a rainy day reserve. But Schwartzman wasn't eager to embark on a hiring spree and was thinking more short-term. Soon after Nico wired Blackstone the money in early 1989, he hit on a money-making formula that would throw off hefty dividends to Blackstone and his partners, as well as to Nico. By this time, the burdensome M&A fee-sharing arrangement with Shearson had expired, and only Nico and the buyout fund's investors shared in Blackstone's M&A fees. What's more, Nico's cut was of M&A earnings after expenses, including the payments to fund investors. Schwartzman decided to sink half of Nico's money into risk arbitrage, or trading in stocks of takeover targets. Arbitrageurs, ARBs for short, bet on the likelihood and timing of takeovers and mergers that have been announced but not yet completed. Typically, a target stock will sell for less than the offer price to reflect the risk that the deal may not go through, and the fact that even if the deal is completed, the shareholder can't collect until sometime in the future. If something goes wrong with the deal, the target stock can plummet. But in spite of the risk, many big brokerages wagered tens of millions of dollars on takeover stocks and earned a pile of profits in the 80s with the explosion of takeover activity. That March, Schwartzman lured a seasoned ARB, Brian McVeigh, along with his team from Drexel. McVeigh's resume was blemished. Smith Barney and Harris Upham and Company had dumped him and his crew after they suffered massive losses in the October 1987 stock market crash. Overall, though, his record sparkled. From February 1983 to September 1987 at Smith Barney, and then from May 1988 to March 1989 at Drexel, McVeigh's arbitrage funds had returned on average 39% a year. Blackstone formed a joint venture with McVeigh along the lines of the one it had formed with Larry Fink for the fixed income investment affiliate. McVeigh and his group were allotted a 50% interest in Blackstone Capital Arbitrage and were handed custody of about $50 million of Nico's money and were told to go at it. Blackstone couldn't have picked a worse moment to ramp up in arbitrage. The economy was just beginning to slow, putting the brakes on takeovers, and by October 1989, LBOs and most takeover activity had screeched to a halt. The death knell for the M&A boom was the unexpected collapse of a $6.8 billion employee-led buyout of UAL Incorporated, the parent of United Airlines, that October. McVeigh's group, which had amassed a large position in UAL's stock, lost a bundle when the airline's shares plunged from a high of $294 to less than $130. Many other of his holdings nosedived as well. The ARB unit took an 8% loss. Schwartzman's reaction was quick and severe. 10 months after McVeigh had arrived at Blackstone, he and his team were axed. Blackstone Capital Arbitrage was shuttered, and the $46 million that remained of the original $50 million was stowed away in the very safest kind of securities, certificates of deposit. Blackstone wasn't the only firm with heavy arbitrage losses in October, nor was it alone in firing traders or bolting the arbitrage business. Some of Wall Street's best-known ARBs lost their jobs in the winter of 1989 when the takeover market evaporated. But it's safe to say that few received a tongue-lashing on their way out the door, like the one Schwartzman gave McVeigh. As Schwartzman saw it, McVeigh, like Winograd, had made an avoidable blunder that cost the partnership dearly. Few sins were worse in Schwartzman's world. Winograd and McVeigh were just the first of many partners and lesser employees hired and jettisoned from 1989 to 1991. Hotshot investment bankers the firm had lured away from First Boston, Shearson, and Morgan Stanley came and went in less than a year, let go for failing to rustle up deals and revenue in a down market. The best-known casualty was Richard Ravitch, a business executive and public official renowned for revitalizing New York City's derelict subway system in the mid-1980s, when he was chairman of New York's Metropolitan Transportation Authority. Like Felix Rowatin, who had helped New York stave off bankruptcy in the 1970s, Ravitch was a local legend with a dazzling resume. In 2009, he was named the state's lieutenant governor, one of the few non-politicians ever to be offered the post. But his talents didn't translate well to Blackstone's deal-driven pressure cooker culture. "He was a terrific manager. He was not a great deal guy," says a former Blackstone partner. Not all who left were summarily executed. Some who fell from grace were eased out quietly or quit. Others were exiled from the 31st floor, where Schwartzman and Peterson held court, to humbler quarters one floor below before getting the axe. The move to the 30th floor was brutally symbolic. Ringed by partners' offices, the upper floor was the seat of activity and power, whereas the sparsely populated lower floor was home to accounting and payroll, and a place to warehouse documents. After a few had been kicked downstairs, the 30th floor came to be seen as a departure lounge for those about to be sent packing, a death row for the condemned. Junior staff members jokingly dubbed the space the Aloha Suite. "Steve was a very tough boss," says Henry Silverman, the former CEO of the travel and real estate conglomerate Cendant Corporation, and a billionaire financier who was a Blackstone partner from early 1990 to late 1991. "At one point, I was in my office working on a deal with the team, and Steve walked in and shook his finger at us and said, 'Remember, I don't like to lose money.' I heard that many times from him over the years. He needed to remind us that he wasn't among the minority who likes to lose money." Beyond the message Winograd's summary termination sent to others at the firm, Edgecombe had another lasting and more beneficial repercussion. Realizing that a second costly stumble could do lasting harm to Blackstone, or perhaps even consign it to an early grave, Schwartzman decided that the firm's process for vetting investments needed to be formalized. From then on, partners would have to submit a researched and tightly reasoned proposal that would be shared with all other partners. Schwartzman would remain the final arbiter, but henceforth there would be a full airing of every deal's possible pitfalls before he decided whether to go forward. "I didn't want people lobbying me at my desk or whispering to me in a corridor. Every deal would get vetted in front of the entire partnership, and not just once," Schwartzman says. "It would be the job of the partners to poke holes and lay out the risks without anyone getting huffy or defensive. It wasn't a personal attack. People had to realize it wasn't their deal being criticized. It was the firm's deal, and the process was to protect the firm. Had we not had Edgecombe, people might still be lining up at my door." Though the new procedures didn't immunize Blackstone from making bad investments, Schwartzman is convinced they cut down their frequency. The more formalized review process also made the decision to invest a collective one. This insulated individual partners from blame and from Schwartzman's wrath if deals went sour. Chapter 7. Presenting the Steve Schwartzman Show. By 1989, less than 4 years after Blackstone's founding, Schwartzman was the firm's uncontested leader. Peterson, who'd arguably done more than his young partner to give life to Blackstone, continued to wine and dine clients and initiate deals. Indeed, some of Blackstone's most profitable LBOs in those early years stemmed from Peterson's network of corporate connections, and he still reeled in fat M&A paychecks. In 1989, a year when the new firm would be tested by bad investments and the downturn of the credit markets, Peterson once again drew on his friendship with Sony's Akio Morita to land a prime M&A assignment, advising Sony on its $5 billion purchase of Columbia Pictures Entertainment Incorporated for a $9.9 million fee. But it was Schwartzman who performed the majority of the grunt work at the firm, hiring, firing, executing the business plan the two had devised, deciding which LBOs to pursue, and trying to pick up the pieces of Edgecombe. By decade's end, Peterson had forged a parallel career as a big-picture thinker and author, a shift, he says, that he and Schwartzman anticipated. I was extremely active in the building years, raising money and getting clients and attracting people. But Steve was the CEO and ran the business. I already had that CEO experience at Bell and Howell and Lehman, and I was very confident he could do the job. I had equal powers in major decisions, and if I learned something about the business that troubled me, I'd talk to him. I wasn't going to second-guess him. Starting with essays, he wrote for the New York Times and the New York Review of Books, and an article in the October 1987 Atlantic that won a National Magazine Award, Peterson took to blasting away at Washington's spendthrift ways and its addiction to raising money by selling treasury bonds to foreigners. He extended his crusade to speeches and books. The thrust of his argument was that the ballooning federal debt inevitably would sap America's competitiveness in the world economy. The irony of Peterson's political passion was not lost on the press at the time. Newsday columnist Alan Sloan pointed up the disconnect between Peterson and Stockman's inveighing against government deficits and corporate overborrowing, and the fact that a surfeit of debt had ruined Edgecombe. An article in Barron's dubbed Peterson a Cadillac Cassandra and remarked, like many a social scold before him, Peterson's admonitions do not always match his actions. Peterson says government borrowing is different from LBO debt. The former, he says, is done off the books or through fictitious trust funds, and the public that foots the bill has little understanding of its scope or consequences. By contrast, LBO borrowing is a controlled procedure carried out by more or less sophisticated and knowledgeable parties who are far better able to assess the facts, the risks, and the rewards. Often it seemed like Peterson's mind drifted to those larger public issues. During investment committee and management committee meetings, he would scrawl away furiously on yellow legal pads, preparing his next speech or book. But his brain could entertain more than one intricate line of thought at a time. Jonathan Colby, who worked at Blackstone from 1989 to 1996 before moving to another buyout firm, Carlyle Group, describes his first job interview with Peterson. It began in Peterson's office, then shifted to a limo that took Peterson to an event where he was to speak. Peterson drafted his speech in the car, scribbling away on his legal pad the whole time, while Colby talked on, Colby says. Later that evening, Colby met with Schwartzman back at Blackstone's offices. Steve asked me how it went with Pete. I told him I don't think Pete heard a word I said. So Steve called up Pete at home and asked him what I'd said. Pete was able to repeat all of it, virtually verbatim. Peterson rarely deigned to shoot the breeze with junior or mid-level employees. One, who spoke with Schwartzman almost daily, says Peterson was remote, never once sitting down to talk. Many ex-staffers recall passing him on the way to the elevator, accompanied by luminaries like Henry Kissinger, who sometimes stopped by for lunch. They remember the annual Blackstone Christmas bashes Peterson hosted, where, decked out as Santa Claus, he would distribute Hermes ties to the men and scarves to the women. For one party, Blackstone chartered a boat with a helipad to navigate the waters off Manhattan. Peterson was perceptibly uncomfortable mingling with anyone under the age of 30, says a former associate, then in his 20s. The joke was that Pete wanted a helipad so he could make a quick getaway and not have to spend time talking to younger people. Nevertheless, Peterson continued to shape the firm by his tone, veterans say. He was absolutely a presence, a day-to-day presence, really, throughout the 90s. Through his role on the investment and management committees, says partner Lawrence Guffey, who calls Peterson a compass for the firm. It was Schwartzman, though, who set the agenda, and no one would ever accuse him of being aloof or detached. He was a ferociously engaged boss. His ambition was manifest while he was growing up in Huntington Valley, Pennsylvania, a Philadelphia suburb. In a revealing anecdote in the 2008 magazine profile, Schwartzman recounted how as a teenager he had urged his father to develop the family store, which sold linens and housewares, into a chain. The elder Schwartzman retorted that the business was fine just as it was, and he intended to keep it that way. Unsatisfied with that answer, young Steve kept hectoring his father. I saw the business as a model you could expand nationally. If you look at how Bed Bath & Beyond has done, that probably wasn't a terrible judgment, Schwartzman says. My dad had no interest whatsoever in doing it. He was a very bright person, but he was not aggressive. In school, Schwartzman's competitive drive was funneled into sports. He could fly, man, says Bobby Bryant, who ran track with Schwartzman at Huntington Junior High School and who remains a friend. In junior high, he was only 0.2 seconds off the national junior high record for the 100-yard dash. He anchored our relay team. He was a short guy, but he could jump up and grab the basketball rim. Schwartzman also excelled academically at Abington High School and won a spot at Yale in 1965, where he majored in social sciences. He was a solid A and B student, recalls Jeffrey Rosen, a Yale classmate and friend, who today is deputy chairman of Lazard, the investment bank. Steve was an intense, competitive athlete, Rosen says, who loved to play touch football and soccer in the large interior courtyard at Davenport College, where he resided. He was also something of a ladies' man, which was no small achievement given that Yale was still an all-male school at the time. He struck up a friendship with Davenport's dean, Horace Taft, a prominent physicist, and his wife, Mary Jane, who loved the ballet. She kindled a fascination in Schwartzman for dance. In his junior year, Schwartzman started a club, the Davenport Ballet Society, and arranged for its members to see a dress rehearsal of the Nutcracker Suite by George Balanchine's New York City Ballet at Lincoln Center. Later that year, Schwartzman staged a dance festival at which students from nearby women's colleges performed. Rosen suspected Schwartzman started the club, at least in part, as an excuse to meet girls. Yet the event was a big hit. Schwartzman also won an invitation to Skull and Bones, the secret and elite society of Yale seniors, whose alumni include both Presidents Bush. George W. Bush joined Skull and Bones in 1968, a year before Schwartzman, and the two knew each other, but not well, Schwartzman says. Fresh out of Yale and off the family dole in June 1969, Schwartzman set off to try his luck on Wall Street. Through a contact in the Yale admissions office, he landed a position at Donaldson, Lufkin & Jenrette, an investment bank. There was little glamour or glitz to this young banker's life, though. As a penny-pinching plebeian, he rented tiny flats by the month in gritty neighborhoods. His first was a fourth-floor walk-up on the Lower East Side, next to the precinct house where the opening sequence of the 1970s television series Kojak was shot. Cockroaches skittered away when he arrived home and flipped on the lights. A subsequent rental on 2nd Avenue and 49th Street, above the Midtown Shade Company, was 1.5 rooms, with no kitchen and a common bathroom down the hall. The living conditions were a come-down from the ivied world of Yale, as was his stint at DLJ, where his energy and cleverness didn't make up for his cluelessness about finance. At Yale, he'd studied psychology, sociology, and anthropology. The business world was terra incognita. They gave me an office and a secretary, but I was utterly unprepared for any commercial enterprise, let alone a fast-moving one like DLJ and the securities business. I had no knowledge of accounting. I didn't even know what a common stock was before I went there. He calls his time at DLJ a very searing experience. Even so, he says, he showed enough raw talent to earn a farewell lunch with DLJ senior partner Bill Donaldson. I'm not sure I did anything to merit that lunch, other than the fact that Bill had hired me, Schwartzman says. I asked him why he had hired me, because in my view, I had provided no value added for his firm. Donaldson, Schwartzman says, answered, I make bets on people on my own instincts, and my instinct is that someday you're going to be the president of DLJ. Donaldson says he has no memory of the lunch or of making such a statement, but says Schwartzman was a hard-working and promising young man. He was accepted to business school at Harvard and got his MBA in 1972. After graduating, he entertained offers from Lehman Brothers and Morgan Stanley. Back then, Wall Street still was ethnically divided into the WASP firms of Morgan Stanley and First Boston, the mostly Catholic Merrill Lynch, and the elite Jewish houses of Lehman, Goldman, and Solomon Brothers. Those divisions would begin to break down later in the 1970s, but Schwartzman claims he was only the third Jew to receive a job offer from Morgan Stanley. When the bank's president, Robert H.B. Bob Baldwin, extended the offer, he qualified it, telling Schwartzman he would have to change his personality to fit in. Schwartzman told him he wouldn't do that, and chose Lehman. The Steve Schwartzman who became the driving force of Blackstone reflected the verve and talent of that younger man. He also had paradoxical qualities. In Blackstone's early years, he worked tirelessly, logging 14-hour days, his mind constantly immersed in ways to strengthen the fledgling business. Associates and bankers fielded calls from him at all hours to hash over ideas. He would often call me on Saturday morning to ask me what I thought of this or that, and I would call him, says Jimmy Lee, the chemical bank lending chief. He was building his firm, I was building mine, and we reinforced each other. Former partner Brett Perlman, who worked at the firm from 1989 to 2004, remembers as a young employee getting voicemails from Schwartzman left at 5:30 a.m., commenting on memos Perlman had left him the night before. The calls spoke volumes, both about Schwartzman's attentiveness and about the work ethic he demanded. Steve never expected more out of you than he expected out of himself, says Perlman. To many, the desire and drive were linked uncomfortably to a less attractive quality. On Wall Street, where money is the yardstick of success, greed is as ubiquitous as exhaust fumes at Daytona. But even by the standards of Wall Street, many considered Schwartzman a money grubber. When I worked with Steve, he was aggressively greedy, says one former partner. But he didn't try to hide it. He was always honest and straight, and his word was his bond. A lot of people motivated by money are elliptical and disingenuous. They will put their arm around you and reach into your pocket. Whereas Steve would come up to you and say, "I'm going to try and take your wallet." A banker recalls once asking a Blackstone partner about Schwartzman's athletic prowess. I asked him if what I'd heard was true, that Steve was good at basketball and could jump really high, the banker says. He said, "Yeah, if he's jumping for a bag of money." As he grew richer, the displays of his wealth became more conspicuous and irksome, even to other financial types. The head of another private equity firm recalls walking along a white sand beach in St. Bart's in the Caribbean with his children in the 1990s, when an enormous yacht pulled into the harbor and weighed anchor. Two jet skis, piloted by crew members, emerged from the boat and motored in with a cargo of a folding table and chairs, big umbrella, tableware, a wine bucket, and fancy food. After laying the table, the two buzzed back to the yacht to retrieve a tall and striking woman and a shorter man. Moving in to see who was responsible for this strange scene, the witness recognized Schwartzman and his wife. "Here I am, schlepping my kids around, drenched in sweat, and Schwartzman pulls up in a yacht to have lunch. To say it was ostentatious is an understatement. I'm not pleading poverty here, but I really did feel like there should be a revolution." Schwartzman had a softer side. The same person who mercilessly hounded Stephen Winograd from Blackstone over the Edgecombe debacle also cultivated warm relations with young recruits such as Howard Lipson, David Blitzer, and James Mossman, furthering their careers. He took pains to remember subordinates' wedding anniversaries and birthdays. "If you were going through something tough personally, Steve made a point of calling. He was good about stuff like that," Lipson says. He could be compassionate, too. When Stephen Fenster, a friend and former Lehman partner, came down with a fatal form of pancreatic cancer, Schwartzman saw to his medical treatment. After Fenster died, Schwartzman and Alan Kaplan, another Lehman alumnus, raised money to endow a professorship in his name at Harvard Business School. He was also free of heirs. He enjoyed working directly with young analysts and associates, for instance, and often solicited their views directly. On the eve of an investment committee meeting, former partner Brett Perlman says of his early years at the firm, Schwartzman would often call to get Perlman's views about a proposed deal. "He always did that with the younger people," Perlman says. "He knew he needed that other avenue of conversation." Early on, Schwartzman stood out in a field of aspiring buyout moguls, says one investor who first met him in the early 1990s. "I just remember thinking, this guy is a friggin' dynamo. Holy moly! He was all energy, all these different insights and thoughts," says Mario Giannini of Hamilton Lane, which advises pension funds and other investors. "Who is this guy? He has this sort of blend of self-confidence and self-deprecating style that was interesting. At the time, it was a very different style from a lot of his buyout peers. He can be so self-deprecating, and you don't normally hear that from people in the industry. It's disarming sometimes. And yet, as you listen to him, he's just very smart." Schwartzman had an unfiltered quality, as the head of another private equity firm puts it. "He was enthusiastic and spontaneous, and at times just plain brash and oddly insensitive. His manner could thus charm or irritate accordingly." There's something impishly, immaturely admirable about Steve, this person says. Even friends and partners who were fond of him found themselves rolling their eyes at the ill-considered thoughts that escaped his mouth on occasion. Internally, there was no question that Schwartzman was the boss, but he didn't dictate decisions from the top. "Steve is not the sort to lay down the law and say, 'I think we should do this,'" says former partner Simon Lonergan. He didn't need to dominate the room. He preferred to hear views from around the table before making a decision. Still, an arrogance could shine through at times. In 1990, he told a Wall Street Journal reporter that Blackstone's success derived from his ability to explain financial stuff to morons, and he had a penchant for putting down competitors and others behind their backs. His seeming compulsion to brag about being the first Jew admitted to Skull and Bones and the first banker in history to orchestrate a sealed bid corporate auction rubbed many the wrong way. Despite his savvy as a banker and manager, even after years as a CEO, he could be strangely tone-deaf and tactless at times. At Blackstone's annual meeting with its fund investors in Florida in the spring of 2008, he put his foot in his mouth while explaining why a buyout Blackstone had planned of a residential lender, PHH Mortgage, had collapsed that spring. Trying to buy a mortgage bank in the midst of the subprime crisis was the equivalent of being a noodle salesman in Nagasaki when the atomic bomb went off, he said. Not a lot of noodles left, or even a person, and that's what happened to us on this deal. The radioactive jest, which quickly leaked out to the press, could not have come at a worse time, as the firm was trying to catch up to competitors like Carlyle and Texas Pacific Group in Asia. Schwartzman always has a few off-the-cuff zingers that leave heads shaking, says a limited partner who was there. As the firm grew larger and went public, that blindness to the way he was perceived became a serious liability. Chapter 8. End of an Era, Beginning of an Image Problem. The merger mania that had heated up in 1988 intensified in early 1989, fueling Blackstone's M&A unit, which advised on $8 billion of deals that year, taking in fees from clients such as Sony, PepsiCo, French computer maker Société des Machines Bull, and Verity Corporation. The firm also lined up a buyer for the National Enquirer, the supermarket tabloid. Another fountain of fees was Larry Fink's bond investment affiliate, Blackstone Financial Management, which turned profitable within months of its launch. Fink used just $150,000 of the $5 million credit line Blackstone had provided to start the joint venture, and he quickly repaid that. By the end of 1989, Fink was managing $2.7 billion of outside investors' money, more than four times the $585 million his group had raised a year and a half earlier. That year, Fink's team pulled in $13.4 million in management fees, posting a $3.9 million net profit. Blackstone's partners had struck gold. They collectively owned 40% of a successful, fast-growing money manager, and it had cost them next to nothing. But the waning months of the decade were marked by mounting anxiety over a faltering economy, and what that would mean for leveraged buyouts. In the early fall of 1989, fears began to surface that a raft of recent LBOs would buckle under their onerous debt loads. As the year wore on, panicked lenders started to cut off financing for future LBOs altogether. The brewing economic storm battered Blackstone early. It had aggravated the financial ills of Wix, the textiles and home improvement conglomerate Blackstone had bought, and triggered the demise of both Edgecombe and Blackstone's risk arbitrage operation. The turn of mood in the markets would clobber the firm a fourth time that year, nearly capsizing Blackstone's $1.6 billion buyout of Chicago and Northwestern, a regional railroad, and threatening the very existence of Donaldson, Lufkin, and Jenrette, Schwartzman's first employer out of college and one of the main lenders for the purchase. In the CNW deal, like Transtar, Blackstone stepped in as a white knight, an ally of management, for a company facing a hostile takeover bid. In April 1989, Japonica Partners, a Drexel-backed corporate raider, launched